from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. In this hour of Forum, how a new approach to pediatrics is connecting the dots between childhood trauma and adult health problems. New research shows that parental divorce, sexual abuse, poverty, and neighborhood violence can lead to disease and illness later in life, including cancer and heart disease. We'll talk with a San Francisco physician whose clinic is taking a new approach with children and adolescents in low-income neighborhoods, and getting national attention in the process. We'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome once again to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, sitting in this week for Michael Krasny. Well, it might not surprise you to hear that stress, poverty, and traumatic experiences in childhood can lead to anxiety and mental health problems, including depression, in adulthood. But what about a connection between childhood poverty, broken families, anxiety, and cancer later in life, or heart disease? Could it be that that kind of stress changes the body chemistry and leads to a wide range of chronic illnesses, even early death? Well, our guest this hour believes exactly that. Dr. Nadine Burke is medical director and founder of the Bayview Child Health Center, and she joins us now as part of our first-person series on the leaders, innovators, and others who make the Bay Area unique. Dr. Burke, good to have you with us.
Good morning. It's an honor to be here.
You went to medical school at UC Davis. You did your residency at Stanford. You got your MPH from Harvard. You could have probably written your own ticket, I would think, in this field. What made you open up this clinic in this neighborhood in San Francisco, in the Bayview?
Well, I've always had an interest in serving vulnerable communities. And when I finished my residency at Stanford, CPMC was looking for someone to develop programs to reduce health disparities for children in San Francisco.
CPMC, California Pacific
Medical Center. That's right. That's right, California Pacific Medical Center. And so they recruited me, and it was absolutely the opportunity to do what I had always dreamed of doing, which was really bring innovation and top quality services to families with the greatest need.
And why that neighborhood? Was it their idea to open a clinic there, or did you, knowing the Bay Area, say, this is where I want to open up?
Well, really what we did was just look at the data about health disparities or inequalities in health outcomes in San Francisco. And Bayview Hunters Point has the highest density of children of any neighborhood in the city and also had some of the worst health outcomes of any neighborhood in the city.
So, and some of those outcomes are what?
Well, a child born in Bayview is expected to live about 14 years shorter than a child born in Russian Hill. So when we think about differences like that in our little city of San Francisco, that exists, or when you look at the infant mortality rate, where San Francisco is leading in technology and services for newborns and infants, and yet Bayview Hunters Point has one of the highest infant mortality rates in the state.
And what attributes What causes it? And I mean, this is not new, and this has been happening for a long time, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, that was exactly the question that I was asking. I think that we're taught in I was taught in my medical training and also in my public health training that, you know, there's access to care, there's quality of care, there's services to low income or communities of color, and making sure that they're culturally competent and appropriate. And so I felt like, great, you know, we'll bring all that to the community and we should see some of these health disparities go away. And we did see some of them go away. So our asthma hospitalization rate went from the highest in the city to extremely low. Our clinic has had very, very low asthma hospitalization rates. Our immunization rate went from about 50% in our patients to greater than 90%. We now run usually around 94 to 96% of our childhood immunizations. But when it comes to long-term health outcomes, obviously we haven't had the time to measure, long-term outcomes in terms of things that you would see in adulthood. But it's clear that these are not the things that are killing our kids.
And that brings me to an article about you and your clinic that appeared in The New Yorker on March 26th. It was titled The Poverty Clinic. And in that article, you connected the dots between early childhood trauma, violence, stress, and those things, and health problems later in adulthood. Talk about that, how you got to that theory or that understanding. Was there a moment where you, an aha moment where you realized, you know, this isn't about asthma per se. It isn't about immunization rates. It's about something much bigger than that.
Well, what happened was in the process of doing the work and providing services at the clinic, we have a multidisciplinary team at the Bayview Child Health Center. So in addition to myself and another physician, we also have a case manager, a psychologist. We host two interns from the Child Trauma Research Project at UCSF. And so we work in a very multidisciplinary way. We have an insurance counselor to help sign kids up for insurance. And we also do tons of outreach. So in the course of doing outreach, meeting with folks in schools and after school programs and churches, and I, you know, I would go out and say, send me your kids, whatever problems you have, you know, let me know. We want to take care of them. And a lot of folks from schools and after school programs took me up on my word and said, you know, Dr. Burke, please, can you see this child? They have terrible behavior in class. They have, you know, they can't pay attention. They can't sit still. You know, I think it's ADHD. Can you write them a prescription? And when I did my job as a physician to do a thorough history and physical, it turns out that these kids weren't having ADHD. What they were exposed to at home was tremendous violence, parental mental illness, community violence, household dysfunction. And in the course of providing multidisciplinary care to these kids, my psychologist, Dr. Whitney Clark, brought me this article, which was the Adverse Childhood Experiences article by Felidi and Onda. And in that moment, it was just, there was the data that completely backed up everything I was seeing on a daily basis, which is that these experiences are harming our children.
So the light went off.
Absolutely.
And you mentioned the adult adverse childhood experience study, which I believe was a Kaiser study, Kaiser Permanente study in the 90s.
That's exactly right.
And studied over a period of time people in San Diego, not just kids, but adults who looked back on their childhoods and reported what had happened to them. Is that right?
Yes. The adverse childhood experiences study, also known as the ACEs study, was done by Vincent Felidi at Kaiser San Diego and Robert Onda, who's with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And they looked at about 17,500 Kaiser patients.
It's a big cohort.
So it's a very robust study. In public health school, we would say this is, you know, strong numbers. And what they found, they asked them about their history of exposure to physical, emotional, or sexual abuse, physical or emotional neglect, parental separation or divorce, domestic violence, parental mental illness, or parental incarceration. And what they found was that there was a dose-response relationship between exposure to these adverse childhood experiences and not only mental health outcomes, but also physical health outcomes. And so what's meant by a dose-response relationship was that the higher the exposure, so for folks who had exposure to four or more of these categories, their risk of ischemic heart disease was double. Their risk of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease was 260%. Their risk of hepatitis was 250%. Their risk of depression was 4.5 times, suicidality 12 times. So there was a huge correlation between exposure to adverse childhood experiences and physical and emotional outcomes in adulthood.
And what's the connection? What's the mechanism? How does that work?
Well, that was a huge question. And that was a question that Felidi and Onda initially did not have an answer to. And I think now the body of data is so robust that we do have answers to that. There's a couple different things that happen. Number one is that exposure to these things. So when you're walking in the forest, you see a bear, right? And your body releases a host of protective mechanisms called your fight or flight system. So you're either going to fight that bear or you're going to run from the bear. And you release adrenaline. It increases your blood pressure and your heart rate, dilates your pupils. And you also release adrenaline is a short-term stress hormone and cortisol is a long-term stress hormone. Now, if you're in a forest and there's a bear, that's appropriate. But if the bear is coming home every night after going to the bar or after, scoring some stuff down on 3rd Street, then that process that is normally supposed to be a life-saving or adaptive process happens over and over again. Dozens of times a day or sometimes hundreds of times a day. And then that can be very health damaging.
And it's damaging in the short term as well, I would imagine.
It is. So in the short term, we see a lot of behavior problems. I mean, that was what I was seeing in clinic. That was, we think Bobby has ADHD. It's damaging in the short term, but it is also over the long term. Not only does it release adrenaline and cortisol, but it also stimulates your immune system. So every time you have this discharge, you also release inflammation in the body. And over the course of time, exposure to chronic stress is actually a disease of chronic inflammation. And that is a big part of the reason why we see increases in diseases like ischemic heart disease and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease.
And if you interrupt that exposure, during childhood, I mean, how long do you have you take the kid out of that home and put him in foster care, which of course can have a whole other range of stresses. The things that we do as a culture thinking we're helping kids may not, in fact, may be contributing to this. Is that possible?
Yeah, I think that about 20% of the kids that I see are foster kids. And most often they go from foster home to foster home to foster home. And certainly that is a traumatic experience for kids. The question is, what do we do about it? How do we stabilize the household? How do we get the kids into a situation where they're not having to deal with some kind of threat to their integrity on a regular basis? And it's a difficult question. I think that it clearly requires a multidisciplinary and coordinated systemic response.
Talking to Dr. Nadine Burke, she's the medical director and the founder of the Bayview Child Health Center in San Francisco. She's joining us as part of our First Person series and making this connection between early childhood trauma and disease later on in life. If you were to teach kids some skills, some life skills that might help them adjust or react to some of these stresses in a different way that would be more healthy. Is that doable? Is that something that you talk about at your clinic?
Sure, absolutely. There's a couple things that we do. Number one is we not only offer resources for kids dealing with stressors, but you have to deal with the parents. We have to deal with the parents. So offering family supports and offering some insight to parents so that they can understand how the things that they grew up with, the coping mechanisms that they grew up with, how although we think that we're helping our kids by maybe using physical discipline or something like that, actually is harmful to them in the long run. But the bigger piece is for a lot of these kids is helping them develop some stability and coping mechanisms for the environment that they're in.
Some resilience.
Exactly.
And how do you do that? How do you go about it? What do you teach them?
Well, it depends on the age. So I like as much as possible to start with younger kids as much as possible.
Why is that?
Children's brains are very plastic, and exposure to adverse childhood experiences is also a developmental insult. So it affects the way that the brain develops over time. And the younger we can intervene and the more we can get kids into a stable household or into a stable environment, then their brain development goes from there. So as much as possible as we can, that we can do that. So one of the things we like to do is, for example, through the Child Trauma Research Project, our interns do child-parent co-therapy. And what they do, that's demonstrated to be a best practice to help the parent have insight into how some of the different exposures are affecting their kids by watching play therapy. And that gives parents great reinforcement in terms of how to do things differently.
And what about the children? Are there things like, well, it sounds like flaky California, but even meditation or, you know, things that can relax you to sort of maybe reduce the levels of those hormones and chemicals in their bodies?
So for teenagers in particular, so kids that are, so for little kids, we more work with the parents. For kids about the age 6 to 10 or 12, one of the things that we do is biofeedback, which allows, you know, you hook electrodes, you hook the kid up to a bunch of electrodes and then hook it up to a computer screen. And they get to go through practice of, for example, doing breathing techniques that help to calm their body down. And with the monitors on their skin, they can see, oh, when I, you know, when I do this type of breathing, I can decrease my heart rate or decrease, control their breathing in a certain way that changes the computer screen, for example, from red to green. And it's an interactive game that they play, and it teaches them how to calm their bodies down and self-soothe. And for teenagers, meditation and mindfulness work, actually, it does sound very flaky California, but the reality is some of the best practice data on how to lower cortisol levels, decrease adrenaline levels, regulate heart rate and blood pressure, improve recovery post-provocation. There's a huge body of data that shows that mindfulness and meditation can be extremely helpful in helping to target the root of what's going on with these kids, which is a lot of the physiologic derangements.
And even for people who are in less severe situations, I mean, a lot of people are under stress. I mean, sort of the way we live these days.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I incorporate it into my own practice when I'm having stressful days.
And how long, what would it take for all these things to really make a difference long term, you know, to reduce the rates of cancer or heart disease or suicide, whatever
yeah.
it might be.
Yeah. I'm really glad that you asked that question. There are a couple things that it takes. Number one is that we need to do universal screening. I think that it's a really difficult subject. It's something that for many physicians or for many care providers, it's tough to ask these questions. But if we're not asking these questions, we're leaving our patients at risk for heart disease, COPD, hepatitis, autoimmune disease, cancer, et cetera. Number two is that we need to have a framework of where to refer these families once we do identify something, right? Because nobody wants to screen for something that's then this huge mess that they have to deal with. And so we need true resources dedicated to dealing with this issue. And number three, particularly on the medical front, we need a reimbursement structure. At CPMC, our Bayview Child Health Center is primarily philanthropically funded. So we require a ton of philanthropic support. And over the long term, we really need to find ways to support this work because it just makes such a huge difference in chronic disease outcomes.
And you need the philanthropic support because the kinds of things that you find work aren't covered by insurance?
Yeah, for a couple reasons. Number one, our patients are largely more than 90% Medicaid, and the Medicaid reimbursement is horrible. And also because we're doing really innovative work. And right now there's no framework for reimbursement for screening for ACEs. Great. That we do it because that's the biggest health risk to my kids. That's why we do it. But We don't get paid for it.
Mm. And the ACE screening is what, a series? It's a questionnaire, basically?
Yeah, exactly. So it's something that we go through. And it's just asking pretty much the same questions from the Felitti and Onda study. And we just go through a checklist that we do with all of our kids at every well child check. So once a year.
What are you asking? What kinds of things?
So, you know, I don't start off by saying, hey, have you been physically abused lately? But we
not a good icebreaker.
No, it's not. But we do start about, you know, I say, you know, how's the emotional health of your family? What's going on? Has anyone come or gone from the household recently? Has there been any disruption? Do you think that your child is under any stress? And then the next thing I ask is I say, hey, you know, we're finding out more that actually some of these stressful experiences have impact on health. And so I'm just going to ask you a couple questions about whether your child has experienced any of these things. And most often, most parents, they recognize it. When I say, hey, you know, has anyone come or gone from the household? And they say, oh, yeah, well, ever since dad went back to jail last month, you know, the behavior has been awful. And I say, you know, and so we go from there. Or I'll say, you know, what's happened? And many of our families, sadly, it's just a matter of course, like, yeah, you know, they witnessed a shooting in the street 2 weeks ago. And so in that case, I say, well, how's their behavior been since then? And they're like, oh, you know what? You're right. He hasn't been sleeping. He's been bedwetting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And do you get any pushback from parents or the community where they say, you know, you're blaming us. You're blaming bad parenting. You're blaming whatever it might be that I can't help for my kids' problems.
So there's a couple things there. I find that I get there's always pushback, but I find that it's really very little. And part of it has to do with our approach, I think, in the sense of every parent wants what's best for their child. Even for parents who are addicted to substances, I've never met a parent who didn't want what was best for their child. And so really aligning with that and helping parents recognize what is actually harming their child. And a lot of it also is aligning with parents' interests in terms of like, hey, you know, your kid's having a really tough time in school. You're noticing that their behavior is really difficult for you to manage. You know, what's going on at home? Have they, you know, what was your experience? When I see a kid who's got an ACEs score of 6, when I look at the parents, their ACEs score is not 0.
And the scale goes from 1 to 10 just to give people a sense of what 6 is.
Yeah, the ACEs score goes from 0 to 9.
So like normal would be what?
So, you know, we would hope that the score would be 0. We would hope, right? But and that is, you know, just assigning a score of 1 for endorsing any one of the criteria that we talked about.
So when you see kids with scores that are higher than, you know, 2, 3, 4, it's reflecting what's happening with the parents.
Yeah. And the other interesting thing, Scott, is that when I see a kid whose ACEs score is 4, I now know that that child is 260% as likely to develop COPD. I know that they're more than twice as likely to develop heart disease. I know that they're 4.5 times as likely to be depressed, 12 times as likely to attempt suicide. That's what I know automatically. And so I know I have to direct intensive services towards that child.
Dr. Nadine Burke, she's director of the Bayview Child Health Center in San Francisco. She'll be with us for the rest of the hour. If you have questions or comments, give us a call. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us. It's forum@kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny. Much more to talk about. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny. Glad you're here with us. And this hour, we're talking with Dr. Nadine Burke. She's the medical director and founder of the Bayview Child Health Center in San Francisco. And we're talking about the connection that they're finding between childhood poverty, stress, anxiety, and problems later in life, anything from attention deficit disorder or more serious things, I shouldn't say more serious, but more physical issues like cancer, heart disease, that kind of thing. If you want to talk with her this morning, give us a call, 866-733-6786. Just to clarify my own point, you're really not – how much ADHD are you finding? Because there is a lot of diagnosis of that in low-income neighborhoods. Are you saying that's not really the problem, that that it's just a manifestation of other things that need to be addressed?
ADHD is really a diagnosis of exclusion. So when you look at the criteria, you have to make sure that there aren't other things going on. And I find that the vast majority of the time, I cannot make that diagnosis. And honestly, for most of our kids, I do actually see in clinic some signs of dysregulation of their fight or flight stress response system.
What does that mean?
So you know, the interesting, if you want to see if a child has a dysregulation of their stress response system, give them a vaccine. Unfortunately, obviously, we don't do it intentionally, but, you know, we can definitely see for kids.
What do you mean by that? Their reaction to it?
Yeah, absolutely. When we walk in to give a child a vaccine, I can tell a lot of our kids who have, you know, your fight or flight system is your hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. So when or your HPA axis, we can see kids who absolutely physically cannot calm themselves down, who get extremely dysregulated and, you know, increase heart rate, extremely upset, just walking in to give them a vaccine, because it's a stress challenge. And you can actually see, I mean, I feel like I can see the HPA axis dysregulation in clinic.
Yeah. So the reaction is out of proportion to
very much
to what's happening. All right, let's go to the phones. Heather is on the line in Oakland. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. I have two children that attend public school, and it seems to me that we should be giving funding to the schools in order to diagnose these kids early, or using your tests that you give them in order to screen them ahead of time so that they can be referred to you.
What about the schools? So is the clinic working with schools at least in the neighborhood there?
Absolutely. In fact, a lot of my attention to this work really came out of a strong relationship with the neighborhood schools and talking with principals and school nurses and teachers about the needs of their students. And we are actually, I'll take this opportunity to say that we are in the process of developing a multidisciplinary center to be able to better address this issue. And in the center, one of our key partners is going to be the school system. Dr. Patricia Gray is the deputy superintendent for the Bayview School Zone. And she has been wonderful in discussing and trying to work on ways that the school district is able to be involved in helping us come up with really comprehensive solutions.
And, you know, it seems like the day of the school nurse is long gone in California. So what would schools need to really to make this work?
I think that schools really need education and training for teachers and other kids, other folks who work with kids, to be able to identify when kids are really having a challenge. Honestly, the big thing is just when to refer, right? Because when I see kids in clinic and I, you know, I always ask what grade they're in, what school they go to, and how they're doing in class. And, you know, over time, I might see 10 different second graders that all go to the same school, and all of them are dealing with madness at home, you know? And so I have these different kids who I know are in the same classroom, and I think to myself, how does the teacher deal with a classroom of 30 kids when 10 out of those 30 kids have major HPA axis dysregulation, major trauma at home, and have some type of trauma spectrum disorder or post-traumatic stress disorder? I mean, I don't think that we wouldn't have a teacher in a classroom with 10 kids who had epilepsy or autism and not give them some type of supplemental support. But somehow we're allowing our teachers in community schools to deal with all these kids who have terrible trauma spectrum disorders who are just expected to teach.
Thanks for the call, Heather. You know, the underlying causes of the stress are so complicated and big. It could seem a little overwhelming, I imagine, because you can't solve all those problems. So what can a school do? What can a clinic do? What can a city do to make a difference? Because we're not going to, you know, you can't transform all of these issues. I mean, poverty and racism and crime and violence. I mean, the list goes on. It's daunting.
Yeah, it's a lot. It is very daunting, but we have to make sure that the size of it and the fact that it is so daunting doesn't prevent us from acting. So about, I would say, a year and a half, almost 2 years ago, then District Attorney Kamala Harris reached out to me and brought me together with Dr. Victor Carrion, who everyone should know. The name Dr. Victor Carrion should be a household name. He's the director of the Lucille Packard Early Life Stress Program. And, you know, through my conversations with Kamala, she said, oh, my goodness, you two have to get together and come together to try and create solutions. And from that, we were also introduced to Katie Albright, who is the executive director of the San Francisco Child Abuse Prevention Center. And we have all been working together with the help of a tremendous local funder, the Tipping Point Community. And Daniel Lurie is the founder of that organization and has been a tremendous supporter. And we have been working on creating a comprehensive solution to bring together lots of different, several different organizations so that we can have a coordinated response. You're right. It's difficult. It's unwieldy. It's hard to get folks to work together. It's hard to figure out what the scope of the problem is. But we have to do something innovative and comprehensive in order to be able to serve these vulnerable children, because otherwise they will just slip through the cracks.
Back to the phones. Let's go to Diane in Burlingame. Welcome.
Hi. I'm going to be real quick. My grandson and my family came from New Orleans after Katrina, and we've been under a lot of stress since then, a lot of it economic. We ended up here in Burlingame hoping my daughter would work nearby at the airport, but she got a job in San Jose. So we're stuck here because my grandson's in the great schools here. But because of the stress of the family, everything you talked about is him. Everything. He's depressed. He's suicidal. He's doing absolutely nothing in school. And in the last couple of months, he's become extremely combative. He was expelled last week for telling the teacher to shut up. And I know he did it because he does it to me, and he does it to his mother. We're at our wit's end. We have him, we take him everywhere we can to get help, but we're not getting the kind of help that you're talking about. And we don't live in San Francisco, and that's one thing. Is there anything comparable to what you're talking about in San Mateo?
Dr. Burke? Does it sound familiar?
It sounds very familiar, and I absolutely understand what you're going through. Unfortunately, I'm not familiar with a resource in San Mateo.
Is there a website or something we could refer her to? Or
you know what? I think that maybe if your staff could take down her information, I would be happy to have my team follow up with her and try to direct her to appropriate resources.
Diane, have you taken your the 12-year-old to to a clinic or a physician? I mean, what kind of health professionals are interacting with him?
Okay, right now he has a counselor at school. He has an IEP at school. He has, recently, when he tried to commit suicide the second time, we got him in Omega now. He, in fact, goes to Bayview Hunters Point Center now, the youth center. But he needs intensive clinical, and that's what we're not able to find for him.
Okay. Well, we're going to get your information. So don't hang up. We're going to put you on hold, and we'll get your contact information, and we'll give that to Dr. Burke. Okay. All right. Very good. I could see that in a job like yours, you want to save everyone mm-hmm. who has a story like that. What's the most effective thing? What can you do at this point with given the resources, giving what you know, giving the economy and all those things? What's the most effective thing that you can do and you are doing to help the largest number of people?
So one of the biggest things that we're doing for the families that we serve, number one, it's just having this resource be part of the primary care home, right? It's really tough for families who are in crisis to be chasing down resources in 10 different places and calling and getting on waiting lists and not following up. And one of the great interventions that we do at the CPMC Bayview Child Health Center is that we have your medical provider, psychology, case management, insurance counseling, it's all in one place. So folks can come to one place and get all of those services, and they don't have to be running around and trying to get these resources. The other piece is clearly educational advocacy is such a huge piece of this work, because usually these kids present when they're failing in school. And some of the things that we can do is figuring out how much of this really has to do with what's going on physically and physiologically and deal with that piece. And then how much of this is something that is more amenable to counseling or, for example, even a recommendation of exercise or nutrition and really looking at the whole child.
And figure out the best intervention.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let's read some email. Amy in Oakland writes, what about policy changes that will actually reduce ACE scores? It's very troubling to hear that the main approach is to teach children how to manage the effect of these tragic experiences rather than preventing children from being exposed to them. It's exciting to learn that we have better data about these effects, but our public policies are moving in the exact opposite direction. Less funding for mental health services, reduced funding for foster care, and little funding to prevent the incarceration of young men.
That's exactly right. I absolutely agree with Amy's comment, and that is one of the big things that we will be focusing on in the new multidisciplinary center that we're going to be creating. A big piece of that is using our experience in doing the work to help to inform policy and advocacy, because exactly what she's describing is what is happening, which is decreased funding for all of these programs. And heart disease is the number one killer in the United States of America. So if we don't want to deal with these issues on the basis of health disparities or mental health or, outcomes for these kids in another way, we have to recognize that we are paying for it in terms of our chronic disease outcomes. So it makes sense to invest those dollars up front.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Another caller from San Mateo. Elise is on the line. Welcome.
Hi. I wish I could have asked a question of your earlier caller, which goes to my question, which is, did the young boy from with the Katrina circumstances, did he show indicators that he didn't handle stress well before that, maybe as a child or even as an infant? My experience, not just with kids that I know, not in necessarily a poverty situation, is that kids inherently, from the time that they're very young, either have the nervous system or the ability to absorb stress or don't, and that parents, then there's a little bit of a feedback loop because parents may be more stress-inducing in their reaction to the infants. And so what I'm wondering is, I think it's terrific that you're focusing on low-income people, and because I think they probably do have a lot more environmental stresses in their lives, but what about just the focus, even among that population, on identifying temperament and people who are going to be more vulnerable to these kind of stressors early? And I would just add that I would guess that there might be a correlating effect to your data about people who have heart disease and these diseases later in life. It's not necessarily just because they were sick when they were young, but it may be that their systems aren't able to handle stress in the way that other people do, and that it affects them, their health later in life.
Thanks for the comment, Elise. Appreciate it. Dr. Burke?
That's a great question, and I have two responses to that. Number one, I want to remind folks that I work in a community where there's a lot of poverty and environmental stress. However, just a reminder that the original ACEs study was done in a population that was 75% Caucasian, 75% college educated. So the correlation between early life stress and adverse health outcomes is not just in low-income communities of color. The second piece around temperament and what the individual constitution, individual susceptibility to stress, this is an area in which Dr. Carrion, who I mentioned earlier, has done great work. Yes, it does seem like the research demonstrates that we each have different susceptibility to stress, and then we each start with a certain level of resilience, and then you can start with a high level of resilience and then just have a very high level of stress that is able to overcome whatever your baseline level of resilience is. Or you can start with a low level of resilience, and depending on the stressors that you have, it's a combination between nature and nurture. So I think your point is absolutely right in that some people are more susceptible, but given individual resilience, there is a certain level after which most people will experience some adverse outcomes.
All right, Elise, thanks so much for the call. And to your point about that original ACEs study, here's an email from Darren in San Francisco who writes, I make my living trading stocks. Since the financial crisis of 2008, this work has been more stressful than at any time since I started almost two decades ago. Would the adrenaline and stress response of day trading have a similar long-term deleterious impact as that experienced by the children Dr. Burke works with?
That's a really great question. I think that overall, the impact of stress and the dysregulation of your flight or your fight or flight system, the question of whether day trading would do that, I will actually say I don't know, because part of the mechanism is threat to your integrity. So, for example, when kids are witnessing domestic violence at home, it's a threat to their survival. And so most of the data is around perceived threats to survival. And so I don't know, although it may feel like, oh no, I'll lose my condo. I don't know if the mechanism is the same.
Well, and to just following up on that point, people who are day traders, not to diminish the stress, but they also have resources that they can fall back on for exercise and stress reduction, all those kinds of things that somebody who's living constantly in a situation where they are threatened personally or see people being killed or shot. That's a different kind of chronic level of stress, isn't it?
That's absolutely right. I think the threshold that's required to take something from the flight or fight response to a dysregulated state, I'm not sure if day trading would do that.
Another email, Christopher in Oakland writes, I saw you speak recently at a panel on health disparities in black communities. I salute your work. I know it's a big question, but can you talk about the roles that race and racism play in creating the stress you're detecting among the young people that you treat?
That is a very big question. I think that, so I will say that the part of the body of work that I look to when I look at the data around adverse childhood experiences was really informed by my work when I was in public health school at Harvard, looking at some of the root causes of poor health outcomes in people of color. And that kind of planted the seed in my mind as to what are the physiologic mechanisms that the body experiences as a result of experiences like racism, where depending on the situation, may in some circumstances feel like a threat to the integrity. My answer to that would be, I think it's very complicated. I think certainly when we look at health disparities, it's something that we have to consider, because it's, in my mind, a big part of the reason that we look at this work. We can't just believe that people of color or, you know, low-income African Americans, they're just unhealthier, right? We have to ask why. What is it about the experience that makes people have worse health outcomes? And so to that end, I'm sure that there is some connection with race, but I certainly don't feel qualified to quote the data on it right now.
Hard to disentangle, I would think, racism from poverty, too.
Certainly, I think that in our culture, particularly the United States, and in urban areas, most of our concentrations of poverty are communities of color.
Yeah. We are talking to Dr. Nadine Burke. You're listening to Forum, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer. Let's go back to the phones now, and Cheyenne is calling from Walnut Creek. Cheyenne, welcome to the program.
Thank you, and thank you, Dr. Burke, also. I find myself falling into at least six of the categories you mentioned. I'm 39 now, and I'm in a way better place. But I'm wondering if there's some way to counteract that through nutrition, healthy lifestyles, therapy, exercise, or is this something changing our DNA irreparably?
Cheyenne, I'm so glad that you asked that question. There is so much that you can do and that individuals can do when they assess their ACEs score and, they recognize that it's high. I feel like I would not be doing this work if there wasn't a lot of hope on how we can rewire some of the neural circuits that are developed over the course of a traumatic childhood. A couple of things that can be done. Number one, regular exercise, when you think about exercise as increasing your endorphin levels that increase the happy hormones in your body, and then also helping to kind of help to metabolize some of the stress hormones, nurturing relationships. And it's a hard thing because it's a little bit of a chicken and an egg phenomenon in terms of when you grow up in an environment with destructive relationships, many people fall into a pattern, partly because of some of the developmental issues that happen with traumatic experiences, where they would be more likely to end up in destructive relationships. But really, nurturing relationships, meditation.
Breathing.
And then also good old-fashioned mental health, talking with a therapist and really doing that work for yourself and kind of deconstructing some of the pieces of how we create our lives moving forward.
All right, Cheyenne, thanks so much for the call. What are give us a success story. Of a kid where you looked at the ACE score, it was off the charts, and you made some changes, and there were some big improvements.
Yeah, well, that is the most fun part of my job. So with sensitivity for HIPAA and health privacy, I will give kind of a general story here. But we had a family where there were four kids in the family. There was unbelievable drama between mom and dad. Horrible breakup. Concern about mental illness on dad's part. There had been a history of physical abuse. There had been a history of crazy altercations between parents requiring multiple interventions by the police. And the kids were watching just awful stuff happen at home. And we're missing tons of school. And we did a care conference. We got the school teacher, the school social worker, our case manager, and Child Protective Services was involved. So we got the CPS worker together for a care conference at the clinic. And it was great. We had we said to mom, listen, we are here to help you and support you. We will give you every resource that you need to care for your children, but you need to do all the things that we are asking you to do as well. And the kids also had multiple physical issues as well, including bedwetting and difficulty with sleep. And we followed them up over time, a couple times over the year. And I just saw them back probably about 3 months ago. And two of the kids are on the honor roll at school. I'm not joking. I am not making this up, you know? And it's just, and we got that mom into parent-child therapy with the Child Trauma Research Project. And it was amazing.
What happened to the dad?
I think there's a restraining order against the dad. So the dad was not involved.
So he's out of the picture.
Yeah, he's out of the picture. Yeah.
And sometimes that's what it takes.
That boundary needed to be set because that was harmful to the children.
Quick email here from Aiden who writes, how do I know when I cross over the line of discipline versus punishment that give my kids stress?
That's a great question. I think that there's a longer answer, but when we think about discipline, you really want to think about discipline is a reinforcement of behaviors that you want. So versus punishment is getting mad at someone or chastising for doing something that you don't like. And the focus of discipline should be to reinforce healthy behaviors.
Quick answer, physical punishment. Is it ever a good idea?
No, never.
All right. Dr. Nadine Burke, she is the director and founder of the Bayview Child Healthcare Center. Thank you so much for being here and keep up the great work you're doing.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell with help this week from Tina Lauerberg and Christina Russo. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer today is Danny Bringer. And our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer here this week for Michael Krasny. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.